Many don't believe that either the trumpets with melodious noise or the infernal din await us where the road ends. But most, I fancy, have discovered that to be born is to be exposed to delights and miseries greater than imagination could have anticipated. That the choice of ways at any crossroads may be more important than we think, and that shortcuts may lead to very nasty places.
Hello, and welcome to the Pilgrims Podcast, home of the permanent spoiler. I'm your host, the progeny, Hannah Long.
And I'm your host, with the most.
This introduction is getting worse.
What's
every
my
time.
Name? I'm the
patriarch.
The patriarch, Alan Long. That's me. Speaking of patriarchs, this week we're talking about
The Godfather Part Two.
The most patriarchal.
We forgot our last host.
In the world, the Corleone family.
Yes, they don't care about anything except family.
Yeah, they're big on family.
Yep. Lastly, from...
Unless your name's Frito.
Frito.
I didn't say Frito.
Like the chip.
I said Fredo. Frito. Is it Fredo?
Fredo. Well, okay, our last host, Professor Lewis. Okay. Well, today we're going to be talking about The Godfather Part Two, which is widely considered to be one of the best sequels of all time. Because... mostly, the rule tends to be that sequels are not as good as the original. And that's kind of the first question I wanted to bring up with is this sequel necessary, or is it just a shameless cash grab? I mean, most movies are shameless cash grabs. Is that so with this one? What do you think?
You mean there are movies that are not shameless cash grabs?
Like what? Possibly The New World.
No.
It was a flop. It was a flop because it's a movie, it's a wonderful movie, people, but it is not a commercial movie by any stretch of the imagination. Anyway, back on topic. We are already off topic. We're the most disorganized podcast on the internet. I think that ought to be our new motto.
No. I don't think that's true. We know exactly what we're doing. We're professionals.
I thought we were going to talk about movie news.
Movie news?
Yeah.
I know nothing about movie news.
The new Star Wars trailer has come out, and the new Jurassic World trailer has come out. And they're pretty epic. Though, I think Star Wars looks much cooler.
But it doesn't have Jar Jar Binks in it.
Yeah, that's a major source of disappointment.
Or it doesn't look like it.
No one except George Lucas.
Now, if they were to open up the opening sequence of that movie with Jar Jar Binks being murdered, people would stand and applaud in the theaters. They would actually stand and applaud. I know it.
That would be great. That would be great. Kill Jar Jar. Maybe
that would send a message.
Maybe Jar Jar could be killed
by the Vito Corleone family.
By the Ewoks, who are also accidentally caught in the blast in this assassination attempt. So there are no Ewoks and no Jar Jar. Yeah. The universe, the galaxy far, far away, would be a much better place. What about Jurassic World? I think it looks cool.
I don't remember the trailer.
It's genetic experiments gone wrong. We've never seen that sort of movie plot before, have we? That's totally original.
Well, that's what happened in California. That explains California.
That does explain California. Explains parts of
New York.
Parts of New York.
Sealock. It's a genetic mutation. Anyway, okay, here we go. So here we go.
We can edit this out.
I might be a genetic mutation as well, though. Some people have said so.
There are parts of our family that have serious genetic...
Alan, you're a genetic mutation.
Yep. My great-great uncle has been staying with us over the weekend, and he has explained to us various parts of our family, but it's very bizarre.
Burl stayed with us over the weekend. He's 86 years old. His father was born in 1862.
Three.
Which is
totally
amazing.
Better.
That's that's some generations going on there. Anyway, so what was the question? Oh, shameless cash grab. Absolutely. I mean, yeah, I think so.
I mean, the first Godfather movie was immensely successful, and this movie wouldn't, let's be honest, it would not have been made if not for
the, I'm not sure what it's about. I don't know what it's about.
Well, I'm going to explain that to you. Just,
all right.
Just wait a moment, and I shall make all clear. Well, I think it's a cash grab, because there was a lot of cash that was involved, but I don't think it's all that shameless, because it's a very artistic piece of work. It reminds me, in a way, thematically anyway, of one of my other favorite movies, or favorite stories, which is The Lord of the Rings, in that both of these movies are unequaled in their portrayal of the corruption of power, of how power corrupts, rather. How you can start out with good or even mildly good intentions and end up becoming something very, very twisted and very, very dark. And this, if the first movie kind of charted the rise of the Corleone family, this one, well, it doesn't document their fall so much as the fall of Michael as a character. Because Michael is really the character that defines the films. The films are sort of a character study of him and how power has corrupted him and how it has changed him or how it hasn't in some ways. So Marlon Brando and all the other actors are terrific, and they're very good, but they're supporting actors. I don't think there's any question of that, because when I finished both of these movies, I was left with one really, really strong impression, emotional, psychological, all that, those sort of things, and that was Al Pacino as Michael. He really, everything else is secondary. So those are subplots. What is going on with him? He just draws you in. He's a very compelling actor, and there are very few actors that I have seen that manage to draw me in like that. But speaking of subplots, this movie starts out, and I'll kind of give you a summary. It starts out with a young boy, Vito Andolini, who is the godfather, the original godfather, Marlon Brando's character, Vito Corleone, at a young age. And he's in Sicily. He's 9 years old, and his father has been killed by a local mafia chieftain, Don Fanucci. And his brother has also been killed. And in the subsequent scene, his mother goes to this Don and pleads with him to spare her child. And he will not do it. He says, no, 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 no. So she threatens him with a knife. He shoots her. Vito manages to escape and immigrate to America, whereupon he is given the name Corleone, and he eventually grows up to become Robert De Niro, who grows up to become Marlon Brando. And the movie is set up as a series of flashbacks, which I'm a little bit torn about how that all works, but we'll get to that. So in the next scene, you're catching up with the Corleone family that you've gotten to know in the first movie, and they've become the 1%. They are very wealthy, and they're at their ranch somewhere in Colorado or Nevada, looking out over a lake.
Lake Tahoe,
and they are having the first communion of their son, Anthony Vito Corleone, and they've got a senator there who's giving a speech. They've got the...
We had a senator come to your birthday party.
Yeah, yeah. Which one was that? I can't remember which senator. You know,
I don't know.
There are so many.
There are so many.
So, yeah, they have become extremely influential, and the threat to the family right at this time is the government. The government and the family itself is starting really to kind of crumble from the inside. But the Senate, by the intermission of this movie, the government has started to try and clamp down on the Corleones' activities.
Well, they're no longer doling out justice for the funeral director down the street.
No, they're much bigger. And that's a convention in most sequels, is to make it a much more ambitious and much bigger story. And that's certainly the case in this instance. Now, this party strongly parallels the wedding scene in the first movie. And there are a number of scenes that parallel other scenes in that movie, which, when I was initially watching it, I'm thinking, this is totally like the other movie. What's different here? Though it ultimately, I think, convinced me that there was something new to be said. And we have the senator who I think is, whoever this actor is, he's so realistic. He seems like such a southern good old boy type guy when he's given that speech.
He is not from the South.
Isn't he?
He can't be.
He can't be because he's a bad guy.
He's a bad guy. He's probably from, well, anyway. I don't want to, you know,
alienate our Yankee listeners any more than you already have.
Yeah, that's exactly right.
Yeah, you know, maybe we should just go ahead and secede from the podcast world.
I'm regionally challenged.
Yeah. Speaking of the senator, what's the deal with him? Why do you think that subplot exists?
Well, it shows their power, how far their power has extended. In the first movie, doesn't he say something like, you know, who's being naive now when they're talking about the government? You know, she says the government can take care of, you know, whatever. The government's basically a good force. And then he says, who's being naive? And in this one, you see, you know, that they bought this senator. And is that true? Can that still, you know, did that go on and does it go on? That's a very good question.
I initially assumed that he was going to be the antagonist, which is something that did not happen. And he doesn't really serve much of a purpose towards the narrative, because he starts out by existing just to insult Michael and kind of remind us that we need to really sympathize with these gangsters here, because this Southern senator guy is a racist. And, of course, we all dislike racists. That's terrible. So he's there to kind of make Michael and the gang a little bit more sympathetic. And then about halfway through the movie, he ends up discounted because they work that out.
They discount him.
They discount him. I will leave it at that. And the only purpose he seems to serve is to be their guy on the Senate committee to say, okay, I think that Mr. Michael Corleone is a decent and upright American.
And yeah, I gotta go somewhere else. See you guys later.
Yeah, I've got a birthday party or something. The rest of the story is tracking Michael starting to try and deal with tensions inside of his family and outside of his family. He's starting to build bridges with Hyman Roth, who is he's a mob boss, but he's not Italian. And therefore, most of Michael's family are not very happy about the fact that he's trying to ally himself with Hyman Roth. And Pintangeli is another member of Michael's family who's very unhappy about that. And he threatens Michael, and the senator threatens Michael, and everybody's threatening Michael. And then somebody tries to kill Michael, and we don't know who done it. So maybe this movie is a whodunit. And I'm really not going to get into too much more of the plot at this point, because it is crazy complex. But it turns out that Fredo betrayed Michael, and Fredo is Michael's brother, who's weak and stupid. And then Kay betrays Michael because she thinks that he's a monster. And she's right. And he kicks her out. She is on the outside. And Connie, who has ended up with another guy after Carlos, Michael killed her husband, she ends up crawling to Michael and deciding that she will, in fact, do whatever he says. Yes, Michael, whatever you say, hon. And that's pretty much the end of the movie, and he kills everybody at the end, and he's left alone.
Well, he kills his brother.
He kills, yeah, but, you know.
He has his brother killed.
And he has Hyman Roth killed, and Pinton Jelly kills himself.
And his brother is kind of being the dad to his children. That's the weird thing, right?
Yeah, that was really interesting.
Yeah, that was a boy, there's a message there, right?
Yeah, Fredo, the real strong suit of this movie, when I finished The Godfather Part 1, I thought, where do you go from this? This is a really well self-contained movie. I don't think there's anywhere you can go from this. But now that I have seen the second part, it feels like they are inextricably linked because it does such a good job of taking these really kind of sympathetic characters at the end of the first movie. I don't think they're as sympathetic as everybody says they are, but really taking you farther down their path into deterioration. Michael becomes just a power-hungry freak who will do anything and everything to maintain his power while saying he's doing it for the family. Ostensibly, his raison d'etre, what he's fighting for is to protect his family. It's all about family. But it becomes so all-consuming that he ends up destroying that which he was fighting for, which is very ironic, of course. Why do you think that is? Why do you think? Do you think it was inevitable that if he made this thing such a big deal that he was going to destroy his family at some point?
Well, it's just business, you know. Nah, I don't know. The two scenes. One of them, anyway, is that when he's talking to his mom, right? What does he tell his mom? What does he ask his mom? He asks him about Pop. You know, how did he
deal with the family? I wish we'd rewatched that scene before.
Because
it's like the only moment of vulnerability for Michael in this movie,
yeah,
really.
And unfortunately, that she, you know, her character's not been really developed enough to where you can really get much from her. But she's such a sweet looking lady that, you know, it's hard not to pay attention to her, but I think that was a very important moment. And the other important moment, though, and I'm kind of like you, I wish we'd watched that before, and it is when he's talking to Tom
at the end,
well, toward the end, and he basically lets Tom know that he's got a guy watching him, and this is his brother, right? And in the first movie, they're sitting across the table, and he basically tells Tom, "You're the only one I can trust."
Well, earlier in the movie, he said that.
Oh, is that right? In this movie?
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, he says, "You know, you're the only one I can trust." Well, and then by the end of the movie, that's no longer the case. He's got apparently a guy watching Tom, and he asks Tom if he wants out.
Yeah, and I've always found Tom an immensely sympathetic character because he feels like an outcast. He has always wanted to be part of the family, and he's kind of an underdog.
Yeah, he is the heart and soul of the family.
Yeah, yeah.
He really is. And that was the most, you know, this is a depressing movie, and it doesn't get any more depressing than that scene with Tom.
Well, it's a very sad movie. It's very sad. Compared to a lot of revenge movies, most revenge movies are supposed to kind of leave you thinking, rah, 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 we're going to get the bad guy and we're going to, you know, it's a very kind of macho thing. But this one shows you the consequences of living like that, and it's immensely sad. And I think it's very effective. I think it all comes back to what Tim Keller says. He says that the problem isn't so much the bad things we do as the good things we do for the wrong reasons. He says, our problem is that we make good things into ultimate things.
And what could be better than family, right?
Yeah, it's family.
History isn't just a story of bad people doing bad things. It's quite as much a story of people trying to do good things, but somehow something goes wrong. Take the common expression, cold as charity. How do we come to say that? From experience. We've learned how unsympathetic, patronizing, and conceited charitable people often are. And yet, hundreds and thousands of them started out really anxious to do good. And when they'd done it, somehow it just wasn't as good as it ought to have been.
Exactly.
But when you set family up as your idol, you know, it'll destroy you just like anything else.
Well, it's really interesting because Michael says, you know, that he's going to protect the family. It's all about what is best for the family. And there's a scene where he's talking to Connie, who has gone completely off the deep end. She's running around with guys and abandoning her children, and he tells her that he's very, very disappointed in her. Incidentally, Pacino's delivery of that line is just terrific. But it becomes clear that what he cares about is not his family, but is his idea of what family should be. If you are, as a woman, are not acting in the role in which he has prescribed for a woman, a mother, if you are not being a mother, then he's going to throw you under the bus. If you are, as a brother, or as a sister, like Connie, are not acting in the way in which he feels you should act, then you have relinquished your right to be part of the family. So he really doesn't care about the family because they're his family. He cares about them if they're doing what he thinks they should be doing. And it ends up becoming a power trip because it's a family, if I define it this way. You know, if you are doing what I say you should be doing. And he has a very, very traditional and very strict idea of what that is. It's very Pharisaic because he doesn't love anyone without condition. I think that's ultimately what I'm trying to get at. If you break any of the conditions of being part of the family, being a member of Michael's family is never unconditional. There's no whatever. He tells Fredo, he says, "You're my brother, Fredo. You don't have to apologize," which means thank you for apologizing. In Michael's speak, you're my brother, but if you don't apologize, you're not going to be my brother anymore. So there's no unconditional love in this family. Everything has its conditions. And Fredo, you bring out a really interesting point about kind of what he symbolizes there. You want to go further with that, or?
Fredo symbolizes Cuba. I don't know.
That's very, very...
Fredo...
That's another very deep or the first thing you thought of.
Well, you know, he's what Michael cannot be. I guess toward the end, he really is willing to do anything that he wants with Fredo. He tells him you're no longer my brother, right?
Yeah.
And that was... Seems like there was a scene there, though, where he's, you know... he kind of betrays Fredo as well. Fredo obviously betrayed him. But he didn't realize, and I think this is true, or it's supposed to be true, that they were going to try to kill Michael.
No.
Right?
No. And Michael sees him as a threat because he is weak and stupid. He's going to do things because he's being vindictive towards his brother, and that's a liability. He sees him as a liability as well.
But he, in his defense, he's never has been given any authority.
No. Because everyone believes that he doesn't have the personality to use it, and it's pretty much true. But Fredo has something that Michael doesn't have, and that's really interesting because he...
Which is what?
Well, people skills for one thing. His friendships are not based on conditions. In the first movie, Mo Green humiliated Fredo in front of people. He yelled at him. I remember him talking about kind of
right.
Cutting him down. And Fredo defended him to Michael. He says, Michael, it was just the spur of the moment. Fredo doesn't hold grudges.
He's not vindictive.
Maybe he's the real hero of this movie. He's not vindictive. He will let things go. And he has a humility because he knows his own weaknesses. Now he has pride, and that leads him to do stupid things. He
tries to tell Michael at one point when they're in Cuba. Doesn't he? He tries to tell him they're sitting at a bar, or they're sitting at a table, and
yeah, he wants to confess to Michael. He can't bring himself to do it.
Right.
But he really wants to. He wants to say, I didn't mean for this to happen.
Right, which is something that Michael would never do.
No, not at all. He plays his cards very close to his chest. Which is, Pacino is that contributes highly to his interest as a character, is because I remember Ebert, I think, or one reviewer mentioning that he never tells you anything. He just suggests. You never know what he's thinking. He just suggests what he's thinking. And so you're always trying to puzzle out, what's he thinking? What's going on behind those dark eyes? And his eyes, he really knows how to just stare and not do anything, and it's magic. He's a terrific actor.
Yeah, I think so too.
In a
creepy way.
Yeah, he's just so intense. The scene where there are two scenes in this movie where he...
But what you don't... Go ahead, I'm sorry.
Where he really utilizes that, and those are the two scenes, main scenes with Kay, which are just so intense, because you just have this feeling of terror. What's he going to do? Is he going to... Oh, he hit her. He's going to hit her. You can just see the anger building, and you have no idea what he's going to do, because he's not broadcasting what he's going to do, and you're just terrified of, and then he doesn't do anything, but it's still scary.
He's like Darth Vader, though, is that they don't show him eating dinner.
No. Right? Well, they do show him eating dinner, and it's scary.
Where?
He's an Italian. He's always eating.
No, where? I don't remember him actually putting food in his mouth.
Well, the last scene where he's having lunch with Sonny and Tom,
he's
afraid of,
at the table, but he's not eating.
He's eating alone at the end of the...
I don't think so. I think he's smoking a cigarette.
Oh.
But that's what I mean is, they're not...
You want to take a bet?
They might. But they don't show these guys sneezing or with hiccups or eating or, doing anything of the mundane. I mean, and I know that's to build the drama, I guess, and make these guys larger than life, but...
Well, yeah, I know what you mean. A lot of bad guys would not be able to take being followed through every moment of their lives
So he just, sits around and gives these smoldering looks and,
all the time.
Right, and that's, it just wears a little... I think it's just... It's one-dimensional. I don't think it's a... There's not a lot of depth there, quite frankly, to me. I mean, he does well, but it's not very interesting.
Well, I think it is. I think because you get to see him, everything he does has that same manipulation in it. He's never going to kind of let up the intensity, I guess,
it is true when he kisses Fredo at the New Year's party, that's pretty intense.
Well, when I started this movie, there were three things that I wanted to see. And because the first movie was very good, but it kind of existed in an extremely romanticized atmosphere. And I wanted it to kind of get deeper into certain things. And one of them was the psychological toll of killing. I at least wanted to see these guys break out of the indifference and the intensity and have some humanity and say, okay, this is, what are we doing here? This is something's going on, something's wrong, to really have some heartbreak or that sort of thing. And I think that I received it in certain ways, not necessarily in the ways I was expecting. Another thing I wanted to see was a break in Michael's omniscience. Because in the first movie, he knew all things. He could do all things. He was going to be successful because he's really good at what he does. And I also wanted to see a sympathetic character who's on the receiving end of this revenge. And I sort of got a little bit of all those. I didn't get entirely all of them, but the first one, the killing, the kind of the break in the way in which they would distance themselves from the killing. That, I think, was provided in the moment when Michael and revealed to Fredo that he knew about that. And also in the scene where he's talking to his mother, you actually see some real soul searching from Michael. He doesn't know what to do. For once, he's trying to figure out what's going on, and he's having his entire foundation, because he is still laboring under the assumption that he's doing this for the good of the family. And I think even by the end of the movie, he thinks he's doing it for the good of the family. But
there's no family left.
But there's no family left to be good to. He says, I only need to kill my enemies, Tom. But in the end, everybody's his enemy. And he has a choice there to make, and there's a real uncertainty there, which I appreciated. And also the fact that he did not predict that Kay had aborted the baby was a nice way for him to be helpless for once, or for him to be vulnerable, because he's so powerful, he can get anything he wants, and then somebody that he would never have imagined betrays him on a extremely personal front, and that really brings him down to earth. He seems like a much less Darth Vader-ish character. You can see the despair. You feel the horror of the moment. And the interesting thing about it is that at that moment I was kind of sympathizing with both of them, because it happened right after the scene in the Senate in which the Corleone family had walked away free and to go on with their killing and their corruption. And I was really disappointed because I was thinking, oh, they're almost going to be defeated. They're almost going to be defeated. And they walked away. And then right after that, Michael receives this news from Kay. And so I was thinking, finally, there will be something that will turn him around. So I was, but at the same time, the horror of her killing his son, of course, you feel that that's a horrible thing. And she's trying to end this killing cycle by killing again. And it's a really, really fascinating scene, because it's so tragic for everybody involved.
Yeah, I agree with that.
And the last thing I mentioned was the sympathetic character on the receiving end of the mob's revenge. That's Fredo, for one. And I think also, to some extent, it's Kay. Now we made fun of her in the first movie, and she's ridiculous, and her hair and everything. But what do you think about her in this movie? Do you think her acting has improved, or do you think her character is given any more depth, or not? What?
Well, I mean, none of these
female.
I don't know
characters?
We here at the beginning, I was talking about what's this about. I don't know what it's about. I don't know what it's about, and it's because the characters are all, to me, kind of one-dimensional. There seems to be this struggle between plot and who's behind what. You can't trust this guy. Can you trust him? Can you trust this guy instead and not trust that one? So they're trying to make the most of that, and do a bait and switch so that the viewers aren't quite sure what's going on, and they do that very well. But what they sacrifice in that, I think, is that there's no character development. You don't care for anybody. You don't like anybody in the movie. There's nobody except for Mrs. Corleone who you just want to,
I like Fredo.
But he's a sleazeball. I like Fredo too, kind of, but he is.
Well,
he's silly, and he makes bad decisions, and he betrayed Michael. All of those things are true. It's just nobody except maybe Tom, that I really have any interest in. And then Tom is relegated to, you know.
Well, I mean, I don't think the characters are uninteresting. I think that they're all bad people.
But there's not enough.
There are no heroes.
I guess there's so many of them, and there's so much intrigue going on that there's. You never figure out. You never really get close to anybody, and maybe that's part of it. Maybe that's what they're trying to get across. But I
would disagree because I do think that the plot gets in the way of things.
That's the word, plot.
And that's ultimately why I think the first movie is better. This one is much more intense, much bigger.
You haven't talked anything about the flashbacks to the young.
I'm about to get to that.
But that really, if anything, maybe you kind of sympathize more with him.
Yeah, I think that the complexity of the plot, you have to pay so much attention to what's going on, and it's kind of a whodunit, and the things are so twisty and so convoluted that it becomes distracting. And the first movie seemed effortless. Now, because this one is much more ambitious, it was kind of inevitable that you were going to have a really big plot that was going all sorts of different ways, and it was much harder to handle. But I think that the first one is better because it realized where to put the ambition and where to restrain itself. Now, that said, the first half of the movie, that's a big problem because you're still kind of distant from it. Now, after the intermission, I suddenly became drawn into it completely. Michael, I always find him, and this is the first time I've seen this movie. You have seen this before.
Yeah, it's been a long time.
Yeah. I found this, the first time that I watched both of these movies, I cared immensely for Michael. I just found him a very compelling character, and I wanted to know what was going to happen with him. I wanted to know what he was going to do. I really cared about what he was going to do. Now, the second time I watched The Godfather Part 1, I cared less because I already knew what was going to happen, so maybe that's kind of what's going on with you. But, yeah, I think that Michael, it's really about him. He's the central character.
Yeah.
Everybody else isn't given really a subplot, but their definition is how they relate to Michael, because it's his story.
Yeah.
Now I think they're given. I don't see how they could be any more deep.
I wouldn't completely disagree with that, but all I'm saying is that because of the. I hate to use the word, but it's the business side of things, you know. I mean, it's just almost like you could almost substitute in, you know, you could almost make this a corporate type thing. And, you know, it would be something very similar, you know, we're going to make this business deal and we're going to use these kind of tactics to get it. And I mean, and can make it completely legal, but it's business, and business isn't very interesting, you know, in that regard.
Yeah, but the second half of the movie, you find out that Fredo has betrayed him, and suddenly this whole thing is personal. Suddenly it's an intensely personal movie, and then the scene with Michael and Kay, I don't see how it can get more personal than that. You're eavesdropping on a husband and wife having an argument about an aborted child.
Yeah, I mean, that's true, but it's just that just kind of drops out of nowhere. I mean, up until then, I'll bet Kay hasn't had scenes, right?
Well, she had a scene. There was some foreshadowing there. There's a scene early on where she and Michael are dancing, and she tells him, "You said that."
Yeah, you're going to get out of the business. Yeah,
five
yeah.
years, and he said, yes, I'll do that.
7 years ago.
And he gives her the same lies, the same half-truths, and the...
Yeah.
And you know that he's not intending to do any of that. And also, at the Senate, on the Senate floor, you can see her. She's in the background. She's in the background watching as he is getting away with all this and lying through his teeth. And you can just see her face crumpling. She's thinking, there's no way to get out of this. He's been lying to me. Now, she's still kind of a stupid character. She's not making very intelligent decisions. But at the same time, she's not gullible. She's not as gullible, at least in the first movie. Because she knows Michael's lying to her. She's not clever enough to figure out how to defeat him. But she's doing what the only thing she feels like she can do, which is striking at the thing he cares the most for, which is children, his heirs,
his family,
his sons. Yeah,
that's right.
And that kind of brings up the children, which to Michael, you never really get any scenes knowing the children's personalities, because they're chess pieces on his board. Every character in this, every family member is judged not on blood, but on the amount of value that they have to Michael at that moment. Fredo ceases to become his brother when he becomes a liability. Connie is welcomed back into the family when she says that she'll do whatever he says.
So do you think you'll be sitting around 35 years from now with your kids doing podcasts?
Probably so. Except then we will be able to do, like, holograms from Star Wars. We'll be able to do holograms.
And I can be your special guest from beyond the... Well,
yeah, we can re-edit all of your audio clips, and you'll say whatever I want you to say.
Yeah, that's right.
Yep, or maybe by that time, you will have turned into a robotic form of you.
That's right.
Your life force will have been transformed into a robot.
My intelligence will be crammed into a 5 gig hard drive, which would probably be all it would take. They might even cram it into a, you know, a floppy disk.
The Alan Long floppy disk. Okay. Where were we?
Well, that Mr. Corleone, Vito, loved him to death. He has all these kids running around, and at the wedding, all these kids are running in around, the big guy, Luca Brasi.
Luca Brasi.
You know, that was just a great, that was a inspired scene, because to Brenda, or to, you know, to Vito's, it was family, and family was close, you know, look what they did to my boy, and all those things. But with Michael, I don't get that sense. I mean, the children were more like,
of course, even Vito told Michael that someone has betrayed you. Now, he didn't tell him what to do about that, I don't think. This is the first movie, by the way. Near the end of the movie, he tells him, he says, okay, someone has betrayed you to Barzini or whoever it was, and it turns out to be Tessio. And Michael says, I know someone's betrayed me. And Vito's like, okay, I know what you're doing, and I wish you were legitimate now. Maybe you could have run a Subway or worked at McDonald's. And he tells him that someone has betrayed him. Now, I don't think he tells Michael how to handle it. Michael ends up having Tessio killed. What do you remember? Whether he tells him how to handle it, because he never has to really handle a betrayal, Vito. Does he? Or a family betrayal? He never has to deal with that situation.
Well, no, I guess not.
And if he had, I suspect he would have been more forgiving. He wouldn't have forgiven without condition. In the scene where in the first movie, he says, I forbear the blood vengeance on my son, Sonny, as long as you let Michael come back.
Well, and I'll say this too, though, is that having worked for a long time around lots of different people, that the Vito character would have been significantly more difficult to betray than Michael. Michael, it's like he's a machine. He's lost, you know, all sense of caring. It would seem. I mean, look at Tom. You know, I mean, the way he treats Tom, right?
Yeah.
And but with With Vito, it would be almost impossible to betray him.
Because you can tell he loves you, or at least he acts like he loves
right.
you.
Right. You know, you get a lot more... It's like when they do the flashback, and the landlord comes in, right, with his hat in his hands.
Yeah.
And he's kind of laughing about it afterwards, you know. He's like... He has a lot more... he has a lot more depth of character and a lot more depth of feeling for people than Michael does. For Michael, people are just to be used and to be manipulated.
I find Michael's character much more realistic in that I think that crime bosses are much more like more like that than they are like Vito. Now Vito's in some ways is kind of more interesting because he's a little bit of a wild card. Because he's so unexpected for a crime boss. He's so kind, he's so gentle. And this movie,
unless you're sitting on a porch over in Sicily somewhere and you cabin to kill his
Yeah,
his
that's
mom.
That's interesting. Because I think that this movie makes him it's an important movie because it makes him less sympathetic as well. Because in the first movie, he was pretty much completely sympathetic. Michael was the one that kind of drew the curtain back and showed you the dark side of what was going on. In this movie, you see the fall of both Michael and Vito. Because Vito kills two people in this movie. You actually see him get blood on his hands. And he also, I think, these are the only two kills in the movie that get significant screen time that are really brutal. I think there's a garroting at one point, but it kind of the guy is dragged off screen. I think in both cases. So I don't think the flashbacks completely romanticize Vito. That's kind of how it feels like because it's a much lighter tone. Roger Ebert. He said that he thought that it was unfortunate because it made the point of the movie seem to be if Michael had been more like Vito, he would have been successful. He would have, you know, he would have ended up with having his family. And maybe that's true.
Yeah, that's true.
And maybe that is true, but I don't think that it necessarily follows that Vito is made into a more sympathetic character. Because he does some very bad things in this, and
oh, yeah.
and I don't think that the
but
director.
But he does them. I mean, he does them to really bad guys.
He does.
And so, you know, there's this sympathy there. You don't. He does them to really bad guys.
He does, but I think there's a balance there. The scene after he kills Don Fanucci, there's in a lot of revenge movies you would have had music surging, and then Braveheart, and then you would have got the bad guy killed. Everybody would be happy, and there'd be happy music playing. That's not how it happens. In this scene, he shoots him, and then he shoots him again, and then he shoots him in the forehead, and blood goes everywhere. And then he quietly walks away and goes home and takes care of and picks up one of his children. And the horror of that is something that the director is not trying to mask, I don't think. And even at the end, there's no real satisfaction when he kills the old guy in his wheelchair. There's not a bloodlust there, I don't think. Now, maybe you could find it in that, and I'm sure that a lot of people do, but I don't think it ultimately portrays the character as being as romanticized as he was in the first movie. Maybe so. I mean, then this is an interesting point that I was thinking of, is that Vito is much more of a kind of a god figure, in that he's a sort of benevolent and
yep, that's right.
There's a deleted scene in the first movie. In which, and I'll try and play it here, in which a fella is dying, And Vito comes to visit him with everybody. And this was one of his loyal subjects. And this guy asks him, he says, can you take care of death for me? Can you make sure that he doesn't get me? I know you can take care of it. You can take care of everything. And Vito says, no, I can't take care of that.
Godfather, it is your daughter's wedding day. You cannot refuse me. Cure me. You have the power.
Tenko, I have no such power. But don't be afraid.
It has been arranged then.
You blaspheme. Zionist.
But you need your old concierge who will replace me. Stay with me, Godfather. Help me to meet death. If he sees you, he'll be frightened and leave me in peace. You can see a word, pull few strings, eh? Stay with me, Godfather. Don't betray me.
The symbolism is obvious, is that he's by the people who are loyal to him, he is perceived to be a God figure. And I think that this movie is good in that it shows his kind side. Like when he's talking to the landlord, he will lean over and pat his hand. But I think that those moves are really calculated. I don't think he's doing that because of common feeling so much, though there may be some of that in it. But he's doing it because he knows that he can manipulate people with it. He can kind of lean in and put his arm around you and say, you know, why don't you be reasonable? And you want to be reasonable. He makes you want to be reasonable because he's such a nice guy. And I think that in this movie you can see how very good he is at using that to build his crime empire. And the other thing was that I expected him to be forced into crime because this evil mafia boss had ruined his family or something. But he comes into it completely voluntarily. He's not being pursued by the mafia. He's not like Michael, whose father has been shot and who is kind of drawn into it. He's somebody that comes into it of his own accord, and he also becomes a rug burglar of his own accord. But and that kind of brings us back to the just this whole mafia thing and the idea of trying to escape from it. If you were going to do it, or do you think it's even possible to do it in this world that they've created?
Well, I'd love to be able to tell you that, but I can't have to get into my past.
Oh, yeah.
My mafia past.
And the FBI don't want you to do that.
That's right.
Because you're operating under a different name now.
That's right.
It's the Witness Protection Act.
Yes. I don't know. It's frightening. The whole idea is frightening with, you know, that's what I know, that when I watched these as a boy, that was something that really just really scared me, is that you could get into this and not be able to get out. And you know, I don't know. I mean, it's a completely different world.
Well, one of the things that I immediately noticed watching it the first time was the scene where young 9-year-old Vito, is trying to escape from Don Ciccio's men, and he's taken in. And I immediately was thinking, okay, he's in Italy. If I was in Italy, where would I go? And my immediate thought was sanctuary. I would go to a church. I would throw myself on an altar and claim sanctuary, because I think that's basically what you would do if you were living in the Middle Ages and you were trying to hide from somebody. And ironically enough, that's sort of what happens. He's taken in by a poor family who hide him on their donkey, and smuggle him out of town, and the last thing they say to him is, "We'll be praying for you, Vito." And that's the first and really only significant mention of kind of a positive religious exercise. The rest of it is mostly ritual. You don't get much farther than that. And it's there for the irony. But I thought that was really interesting, because those people are endangering their lives for some kid, and they're defying the mafia to smuggle him out, and it's their act of sacrifice and grace that enables the only character in this entire mess to get out. It's a really nice touch. It's a really nice touch. So I appreciated that. Anyway. One more thing I wanted to bring up, and then we'll wrap this up, which is that in the end, Michael has managed to alienate pretty much everyone, even Tom, who's his right hand man. And he's kicked out his brother. Well, he's even questioning his loyalty. But the irony is that in the end he gets everything that he wants. Everything that he wants, he gets. And he has omnipotence. He has become the god of his own family. He has gotten all the power. And in the end, he has nothing. And I think it's Keller who says, again, Keller, says that the worst thing God can do for us is give us everything we want. Could there be a greater punishment for your sins? But, and this is where we draw in back good old Professor Lewis. And not to get into the thorny theological discussion of free will or anything, but I think this is a fairly good metaphor for it. He talks about sin, and he says there are only two kinds of people in the end: those who say to God, "Thy will be done," and those to whom God says, in the end, "Thy will be done." I think there's some truth to that often our desires are so messed up, our loves are so disordered, as St. Augustine used to say, that we can't even desire the right things. Even when we try to pursue family, which is a very good thing, we corrupt it into something very terrible. So, anyway. Ratings?
I don't know. I'm going to give it 2.5, because it's so heavy. And it's kind of like, well, we're going to come up with some new ways to kill people and new ways to show you the corruption of people. And like I've mentioned a couple of times, I just don't know where we're going with this sometimes. I think the points about power are well-founded, but it's just, I don't know, I guess I felt like that it kind of just built off the original in more ways. And it's a downward spiral, but maybe a 3, you know, because it's so well done, I guess, but.
Well, I would probably give it 4.5, because I obviously enjoyed it much more than you did, but I think it's a needed counterbalance to the other movie, in that it takes it into much darker waters in a really superb way. And it, in the first movie, you saw Michael come to power and achieve power and achieve his family. And in this one, you saw that he has to choose between power and family, in a way, and he chooses power, which is something that he perceives to be the same thing as family. And it kind of completes his tragedy, because it's the logical end of where we left him in the first movie. Anyway, so what are we going to do next week?
I don't know.
Well, I think we need to do The Children of Men.
I've never seen it.
It's a pretty intense movie. It's because, and I wanted to do it because I'm a big fan of P.D. James, and she just passed away, and she was kind of one of my literary heroes, and I've read several of her books. She's well known for detective fiction, and particularly for her science fiction novel, The Children of Men. Anyway, we'll have to look that up from the library. In the meantime, if you want to leave us your thoughts on the episode, or tell us that you disagree with us, or tell us that one of us is wrong, or both of us are wrong, let us know at thepilgrimspodcast@gmail.com. You can find us, our blog, The Pilgrims Podcast, at longview95.blogspot.com, and find our blogs, Longish and What's He That Wishes So, from there. We're also on Facebook. I've got a Facebook for the podcast and for my blog. And we're both on Twitter, Longish and
Grove Boy.
Grove Boy. So that is the full list of our various social media locations. And it's pretty long.
Ish.
So, in the meantime, keep your enemies close and keep your friends closer.